This week on the show, we talk to two brothers who are expert marketers in the real world. I ask them hard questions about our time-honored slogans.
My first reaction is, that's nice to memorize, just so that you never have to have a deeper conversation about it.
As we get in the weeds of what Freemasonry encompasses, startling revelations manifest.
Are we just so terrified of defining what Masonry is? Do we just stay vague and fall back on these platitudes like that?
When confronted with the facts about how to actually grow Freemasonry, what can we say?
Frankly, Masonry can be even more stubborn than science.
Has Freemasonry forgotten about an entire generation?
Being a member of the millennial generation, it just kind of lost interest, feeling like no one's listening to us.
And ultimately, we confront some hard truths.
If the thing that your lodge has is you're just a bunch of guys who know each other, well, that's not inherently Masonic, and that's problematic.
Plus, an all-new Masonic Minute with illustrious Brother Harrison. All this and more coming right up. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 472. We've got a great show for you this week, as you heard. Hopefully you heard some exciting things in the bumper to the show. First things first, I want to go ahead and thank, of course, our contributors, our fellows, our producers. You guys make this show happen. We've been doing this show since 2011. It's almost 2021, almost 10 years of the WCY podcast. In order to take us to the next level, we took advantage of some things within Patreon. So you can check out a few new things there, just some updates to how we are funding this show. Of course, you can still become a contributor at $2 a month, a fellow at $5 a month, or a producer at $10 a month, either on Patreon or on PayPal. What do you get? Well, a contributor gets your name on the site, a fellow gets your name on the site, and a thank you card that I'll handwrite and send off to you in the snail mail. And a producer gets those same things, plus the producer's pin. Awesome stuff, and it's the same whether it's on PayPal or on Patreon. However, Patreon has a little bit of a bonus in that they just launched a feature that I went ahead and turned on, and that is that you can subscribe at any level at the annual rate. And by paying at the annual level, you'll get a 5% discount on top of that. So you get a whole year at a 5% discount, and it's just because you're getting it billed annually. So it's kind of cool. We also launched two kind of dream platforms on Patreon. We created two new tiers. However, what you get for them, I think, is really cool, and it's unique. And you can check those out if you want. It's Craftsman Plus level and the Legacy Partner level. And those are really just launched at the 10 years of WCY podcast so that we can make huge moves forward and get things moving faster and do bigger projects sooner. So you can check all that out on our website, wcypodcast.com. Click on support the show to see how you can help out. Again, massive thank you to our contributors, fellows, and producers who are currently supporting our program. You guys are the best. First up this week will be the Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison. Let's check it out.
For eight seasons back in the 1950s, kids were captivated by the adventures of Wild Bill Hickok, a shoot-'em-up western starring the dashing Guy Madison. The show brought Hickok, already a Wild West legend, to life as a buckskin and white hat-clad U.S. Marshal fighting for law and order in the dusty, untamed Midwest. The opening of every episode showed his 300-pound comic relief sidekick, Jingles, played by Andy Devine, riding his galloping horse far behind Bill, screaming,
"Hey! Wild Bill, wait for me!"
Ahead of him, Hickok rode his trusty Snow White steed full tilt as he fired his six-shooter repeatedly at an unknown target somewhere in front of him. What kid could turn the TV off after seeing action like that? The production almost certainly did more to shape our perceptions of Hickok than any history book. Like so many of the Westerns back then, Wyatt Earp, Kit Carson, Bat Masterson, and others, the show didn't exactly portray an accurate depiction of its real-life legendary hero. James Butler Hickok was born May 27, 1837, in Homer, Illinois, to William Alonzo Hickok and his wife, Polly Butler. Wild Bill was one of his many nicknames and most likely has its derivation from his father's name. The TV series was accurate in that he did, in fact, serve as Deputy U.S. Marshal in Hays, Kansas, and eventually City Marshal there and in Abilene. He also served as Sheriff of Ellis County, Kansas, for a few months in 1869. In addition to his career as a lawman, Hickok at various times was a soldier, a scout, a wagon master, and professional gambler. He put together his own Wild West show and later teamed up with Buffalo Bill Cody. He even tried his hand at acting, but, well, the reviews weren't good. His exploits as a lawman contrasted with his TV persona and were not exactly squeaky clean. While in office, he reportedly killed Bill Mulvey, Samuel Strawhun, John Kyle, Phil Cole, and others, all under suspicious circumstances, hardly construed as self-defense. When, in 1871, he accidentally killed Abilene Special Deputy Marshal Mike Williams, the town summarily fired him. His reputation as a gunfighter was part of the reason he became a frontier legend and folk hero. The details of his gunfighting exploits are sketchy, but Hickok claimed dozens of victories. In contrast, one of his biographers pointed out, Wild Bill may have only killed six or seven men in gunfights. Even that number would be enough to convince anyone he was a legitimate gunfighter. On August 1, 1876, he played in a poker game in Deadwood, South Dakota, where a drunken Jack McCall suffered heavy losses. Hickok encouraged him to leave the game and gave him money for breakfast. McCall took the money, but considered Hickok's offer an insult. The following day, Hickok joined another game. As a gunfighter, it was his custom to sit with his back to a wall where he could see the room. But only a chair facing away from the room was available. During the game, McCall walked in, shouted, "Take that," and shot him in the head, killing him instantly. When onlookers checked his cards, they reportedly found Hickok to be holding two aces and two eights, now infamously known as the dead man's hand. McCall was hanged for the crime, and when his body was moved in 1881, the noose was found to be still around his neck. Hickok's murder and McCall's capture are reenacted annually at the Deadwood Masonic Temple. So, was Wild Bill Hickok a Freemason? It would not be out of the question to think that the Wild West legend, folk hero, and lawman would have been a member of the fraternity. A check of Denslow's 10,000 famous Freemasons, however, comes up empty. With the amount of time Hickok spent in eastern Kansas and western Missouri, which was near Denslow's hometown, it would be unlikely Denslow would overlook his membership. Also, no other records exist to indicate he ever joined or even petitioned for membership. So perhaps, even regrettably, we would have to conclude James Butler Wild Bill Hickok was not a Freemason. For the Whence Came You podcast, this... wait a minute. I forgot to tell you something. There is a simple chair encased in plexiglass in the Masonic Museum in Columbia, Missouri. It has a tan wicker seat, a basic wooden frame, and three slats running across its back. Except for the seat, the chair is painted black. Presented by the Brothers of Savannah Lodge 71, it is said to be one of the chairs Wild Bill Hickok may have sat in during one of the frequent times he attended lodge meetings there. Imagine that. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, so he is or he isn't a Freemason. No evidence exists officially, except this chair. I don't know what to believe, but I love the Wild West and I love the stories. I've never actually seen any of the episodes of the show, but just really fascinated with the topic. And maybe one day I'll get down there and be able to check this chair out. How crazy is that? Well, now that we've sufficiently intrigued your minds, let's get into this week's main topic, selling Freemasonry. I think you're going to really like this interview that we did, this conversation we had with Brother Scott Duball, past master of D.C. Cregeer Lodge, past master Space Novum Lodge 1183, and also our brother Guide Sobecki, who is a presiding officer of the Valley of Chicago, as well as some York Rite organizations. Let's check it out. All right, everybody, we're back this week, and I am really stoked because I've got a couple guys on the program who I talk to all the time. You know Scott Duball from the Midnight Freemasons, as well as his presentations that he's done around the country, and notably for MasonicCon Chicago, where he pretty much floored everybody and said what people didn't want to hear. And you also probably know Guy Sobecki from various things in the interwebs, and he's also been a guest contributor on the Midnight Freemasons, so I want to welcome both of them to the show. This topic today is called Selling Freemasonry. Now, this is notably different than some of the other topics that we've covered on, say, the Masonic Roundtable, where we've talked about social media marketing and some other elements. This is really an interesting conversation about how Freemasonry has been marketed and how we're selling it, and about some of the efforts of the craft. And what's notably different in this conversation is, of course, I deal with social media marketing all the time, but I've got two guys who deal with this day in and day out in their professional careers. So first up, I want to go ahead and welcome Scott Duball. Scott, good to have you with us. If you could give us a little brief introduction about yourself and any information that you think is pertinent to the conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Robert. As you said, my name is Scott Duball, and I manage a handful of Masonic social media platforms, but in my day-to-day work, I run the social media for a medium to large size nutritional supplement company. It's not a real secret who that is, but not trying to plug my business. Basically, I am responsible for coming up with the content and then tracking how well that content works and how our followers are responding to that, how well we're interacting with that, whether we're putting out the right messages that both are the message that our brand wants to convey, but also the message that resonates with those folks who are ultimately going to buy our product. And sure, that sounds a little sleazy. You know, my wife actually thinks marketing's kind of a sleazy industry. But the reality is, like, the way I see it is people are going to buy products, and I want to be there to help connect them with products that are going to make their lives better, easier. And so that's really what I'm involved with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And I can't think of somebody better really to be on this program between you guys. So thank you for your intro. Let me move over to Guide Sobecki. Guide, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're involved in and why your opinion matters here.
Thanks, Robert. Well, to begin, I'm currently a double presiding. That's not going to amaze a lot of readers and listeners right now, but I'm right now one of the presiding officers of the Valley of Chicago Scottish Rite membership, right around 3,000, and a smaller York Rite appendant body at the same time with a quick 150 members. So I'm sitting over 3,100 Freemasons right now. It's a really different world than standard masonry. It's much more mass marketed. It's much more internal marketing. It's a different world. It's really a different world. Meanwhile, in my day job, I do social media marketing, digital marketing, and public relations for the Brain Surgeons of America. I can't say which Brain Surgeon Association I'm actually with. You could do some research and figure that out, but essentially, all 5,000 brain surgeons in the United States are my clients. I have to know them inside and out, their demographics, their typical background, their personality traits, doing stalkerish digital research on their habits to figure out how we could sell to them, what they need in their membership, and constantly reminding them why it's worth paying dues to stay a member.
That's classic. Well, everybody at home and in the car, wherever you are listening to this program, it should be, at this point, really evident why I brought these two gents on to talk about this topic of selling Freemasonry. Before we get started, Scott, let me toss it over to you. In your own words, tell me the state of marketing Freemasonry today. Just your general thoughts about what's going on within the craft. Anything lacking, glaring omissions, and in the way we're, I don't know, selling the fraternity, or just your general thoughts?
By and large, like the concept of like a professional marketing in any like real official sense, we're not doing. I think there are probably pockets of jurisdictions, and certainly we know that the Northern Masonic jurisdiction has done more work than most, but across the board, we aren't really doing what I would consider to be marketing. And I think that a lot of the products we put out there are the only evidence you really need of that. You know, products that are just not married up with any sense of what our members are looking for or what our potential members are looking for. And so when I say products, I mean, that's a term that I would apply to anything that you're trying to get somebody else to consume. And, you know, if growth or even sustaining our size is the motivation, ultimately, you're trying to get people to consume Freemasonry. And we've talked about this on your show before, but, you know, you're competing against other forms of entertainment to get the attention of our members and our potential members and to maintain or retain that attention. And so, you know, when we put things out there that don't really seem like they align with what people really need, you know, it shows that we're not doing the research and at the beginning. And I think something that probably a lot of people don't think about marketing really begins with that grassroots kind of ground level research. And so, like, case in point, now Masonic education is becoming much more readily available. But 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it wasn't, and it was like pulling teeth to get anyone to believe that that was what people were looking for. And still, there's a lot of people that we interact with on a daily basis, kind of making important decisions, who don't recognize that as being an element of what the consumer, the Masonic consumer, is looking for.
Yeah, those are great points. I'm going to take something you said in your introductory statement, and before I ask Guy to respond with some of his expertise in this realm, specifically, I want to really kind of focus on the Valley of Chicago, because not only is it Northern Masonic jurisdiction, not only is there a lot of, well, there's a microscope over the Northern Masonic jurisdiction because of the amount of marketing that they've been doing recently. But let me jump back to what Scott said. And Scott, you had mentioned this idea of like branding on, like the term of saying, is it on brand? So I want to toss it over to Guide, and I want to ask Guide, if something is on brand for Freemasonry, in a few words, what would you say is on brand for Freemasonry? Or you, can you not do that?
Frankly, Robert, right now, I can't do that. Most marketing that I've seen for Masonry in every form, whether it's the main Blue Lodge, the appended bodies, the wider national and statewide campaigns, frankly, it's just a larger expansion of how our individual members explain and sell Masonry to their friends. And the problem is, we don't quite have a universal, coherent view of what Freemasonry is. There's no unified message, and there's no unified perception within ourselves. For some of us, it's a charity organization which has some fun old rituals. For some, academia, esoterica. For others, it's the history. For others, it's belonging to a social group. And the problem is, so many different regions, lodges, individuals, even just social cliques run with this, and that's how we sell it. We don't have a universal pamphlet in our head to say we do this, 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 and this. Instead, you have five different people saying different things about Masonry. All of them are true, but they're all being talked over at the same time. So no, right now I can't say we have anything on brand because we need to look internally and figure out where we are to begin with. If anything, I'd say we're over-branding in multiple directions. Sometimes we're on topic. Other times, is that really who we are?
I find that without jumping too far ahead, it's kind of the shotgun approach. You know, let's see what happens. I remember an episode of Scrubs back in the day, if you ever watched that. He said, how much Tylenol do you know to give patient? And they said, well, you just kind of take a handful and you throw it at their face and whatever sticks. I kind of feel that way with Freemasonry a little bit. But Guide, in your own words, how about you? I mean, you alluded to a little bit of it right now, but what's the state of marketing or selling Freemasonry, maybe in the Scottish Rite, in your particular area of expertise?
Well, Scottish Rite marketing is unique. There's two sides of it. First up, we are an appended body, and we are after your members. That's what the old past masters will say. That's what they tell the new guys joining. Don't join any appended bodies. We'll never see you again. Yes, we are after your members. We need to survive too. Except instead of bringing in relatives, sons, and nephews to help bring a lodge together, we need to go after existing Masons. So our marketing is almost always catering to existing Masons in Blue Lodges. Sometimes we'll tag in, sometimes non-Masons can attend this or that, but for the most part, we're trying to get inside your head as a current member. Now the snag is, if you look at that as an outsider, I mean, I'm proud to run the Medina Shriners page and the Valley of Chicago page right now, but not all content is going to make sense. We have to carefully filter what we put out in public, not to give away any secrets, but because this is not going to make any sense whatsoever. Even our titles are a bit off. I tell people casually I'm a presiding officer because saying I'm most wise master of the Gorgas Chapter Rose Court of Herod, I'm Scottish Rite northernmost jurisdiction, 32nd degree. Imagine if my mom saw that on Facebook. I mean, guys, let's be honest about that. It's a bit alarming. It's a bit strange. We say it so naturally. I mean, I call you guys Rite Worshipful without even missing a breath. So we get comfortable in that. So appended body marketing, the slang can get a bit heavy, but we're content with that. At the same time, there's the other side. We know that we can only come from the lodges, and we need to save those lodges, because if the root dies, so does the tree, and we are the outer leaves. So you've seen the national campaign, which is founded by the northernmost jurisdiction, the southern jurisdiction, and Shriners International, bmason.org. They are doing everything they can on behalf of various Grand Lodges across the United States to try and promote Masonry and help out lodges. So now we have the side initiative. We have the esoterica. Hey, you're already a Mason. You already know all these, you know, metaphors I could throw at you. Hey, how about you come out for another night a month? And then you have us thinking, okay, we have resources you guys don't. We have large buildings. We have theaters. We have parade units. We have more funding to throw around. okay, how do we get guys in, and then tell them, okay, cool, now go out to your hometown, find a lodge, join for the course of a year, memorize a bunch, and then come back. That's where we're at right now. There's existing members and creating new members. And I have to say, the shift of creating Masons from scratch for appended bodies, it's not easy. It's not easy. The best I can default to is I can give us the best example we can, presentable, respectable, and always link them back to the local Grand Lodge or BMason.org to set them on their path. We can't sell them all at once. Some bodies like to say they can, such as the Shrine, York Rite. You know, the Knights Templar right now really think they could attract people to walk in and want to go through 10 degrees of masonry just to become a Knight Templar right now. Not that people haven't, but it's a bit of a steep ask. Right now, we need existing masons in lodges all over to support the appendant bodies because we are struggling just as much as you are and have our own heritage and history to pass on to the next generation. But at the same time, we now have to help you to create more masons without crossing over with our own interests. We need to help masonry, even if not every mason joins the Scottish Rite, the Shrine, or York Rite. It's tricky, but it's our duty. It's the only way the craft as a whole can survive.
I like the way you put that. It's our duty, right? Part of me just feels like your tree allegory that you mentioned earlier really resonated because of a piece that we read on the program not too long ago, actually. It was a past grandmaster of Michigan who related apple orchards and the way they care for trees. They're talking about the entire tree. You know, the appendant bodies are these outermost branches that they fall off first, right? So we have to protect them. But to protect them, you have to protect the foundation. So that really hits home for me. Before I move on to the next question, that I kind of want to rapid fire some stuff at you. Scott, any thoughts on what Brother Guide has presented?
Yeah, as we're doing this, I'm taking a couple notes just to circle back on and some things that I really wanted to kind of lean in on with Guide. And one of the ones was, you know, we talked about the work that the NMJ has done. And I think some of the research that they've done through an agency has been, you know, to try to capture that voice, both within the fraternity and with potential members. But I wonder, you know, when we have, I think you said that you just threw out the number five different types of belief where we have, you know, the esoterica, the philanthropy, the degrees, you know, and any kind of mix of those. When we have such disparate beliefs and you have people that believe that some of those elements really have no business in the fraternity and others of them do, and you can squarely put me in a camp who believes that there are elements that we are, you know, that we include that really don't belong in masonry. And there are people who believe the complete opposite of me. How do you, you know, how do you bring something like that on brand? You're already kind of fractured other than to kind of allow that brand to fracture and to let different areas of the fraternity where we have appendant bodies or where we have a little bit of the ability to create a unique experience at the lodge level. You know, is that the only way that we can kind of, you know, bring those different beliefs together?
It seems to me what's interesting about what you just said is that, yeah, we are so fractured, but then at the end of the day, is it enough to just say, we're all brothers, though. We're all in the same pool. I mean, is it too hokey? Is it too Rockwell? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, you start to whitewash some of the other problems, which I feel like, and I'll admit that maybe this is my bias, that some of the problems that we face kind of fall on the lines of where people are kind of putting their focus and their emphasis.
And these are questions that I'm glad we're talking about, you know, openly, because we've often said, and people continually, they don't want to acknowledge this idea of fractured masonry, which of course is a problem that doesn't allow us to focus on a brand message or to sell Freemasonry.
The other thing I was going to kick out there was you brought up the point, you kind of referenced, I think, the KT being this, you know, it's rare. Maybe it happens sometimes, you know, where guys are want to join the KT, so they join everything and take 10 degrees just to get into that. And I think about that kind of reflected against the Shrine. And the Shrine, you know, is essentially a fourth degree or a fourth ceremony. So it's a much quicker path, as well as I think they're more clearly stated and what they exist for, whether that's, the hospitals or anything else. And so I wonder, like from a marketing perspective, it seems like they've got it figured out. Whereas the KT is like, yeah, do you run through 10 degrees to get there? And, you know, a lot of time, I was just talking to people complaining about their York Rite degrees. And, do you go through this whole experience thinking it's going to be something and then it's not? The organization has hurt itself on multiple fronts there, where like the Shrine, I think, has really smoothed it out by not having a ton of degrees and also being pretty clear in their message and their approach. What do you think about that?
It absolutely is. I mean, Al, I have to say, I do love the Shrine. I don't say that as a Shrine marketer. I don't say that as a ceremonial actor to be political. I genuinely love the passion they have for the charity and the internal culture. They know they're not the most serious Masonic body. They'll even say, we're not even an appended body. We are a social club of Masons. They have an amazing history, a lovely goofball culture, and they bottle that. Simple as that. You know, you look at a Shrine and think they're having a great time. It's really easy to ask, oh, you have to be a Mason? And then, you know, simply cut the Gordian knot and go for it. Simple as that. And a lot of them just join the Shrine, but still, they stay active in some formats, and they're still in the fraternity. So, yeah, I'd say there's nothing wrong with joining Masons to become a Shriner. Simple as that. As long as you keep that in context, remember to support the lodges and know where you are in the greater ecosystem. You know, some guys are taking this ultra seriously, and that's great. And that's great. I just wanted to play the bagpipes. I just wanted to ride a Harley. But hey, you guys are doing cool stuff. I want to back that up. They know their niche. They're a lot more open-minded than some people will make it out to be. Some think it's all a sports bar, that it's all, very, very shallow. But frankly, they'll say, yeah, that sounds really interesting. I've read a bit of that myself, but just a different social measure.
As you've pointed out, the activity within the Knights Templar, when you get to the top, the activity is still just opening and going through another, essentially, Blue Lodge meeting. But, you know, instead of this thing, it's this thing. And instead of this thing, it's that thing. With the Shrine, that those are really interesting observations.
There's like this sense of authenticity when you've aligned kind of what your activity is and what it is you do as an organization with your message, that becomes authentic. And it's something that I spoke, the first lodge that I was the master in, I spoke to them about this and said, I don't know that we really know what our activity is and why we show up here and why we come here. And that wasn't a criticism so much as a, you know, until you start to have an authenticity in your, or this authentic link between your brand and your marketing message and essentially the activity and the thing, the reasons why you show up and participate, you're going to kind of flounder. And I think that's true about any organization that really can't formulate what that is.
Absolutely. The Shrine, for what it is, knows their niche. They pursue it perfectly. They brand perfectly. And it's exactly what's promised on the box. Simple as that.
Yeah.
You have a good time. The ritual's all public. You know, there's not much to dig into. We don't pretend to be anything deeper, but you'll have a good time by the end of the day. And by all means, they do. So many different interests to dive into. There's something for everybody. They have it down. So now, as other bodies are trying to branch out and figure, well, how do we engage our members? You don't copy the Shrine, because you're never going to do it as well. Simple as that. I mean, right now, the Valley of Chicago is expanding our social events, and a lot of times we talked about, okay, what about breaking away from stag events and bringing our wives in more? Well, we looked at, well, Medina does that, and they do it absolutely beautifully. They have women-only events. They have their own Facebook groups. They have their own community on the side. We can't quite jump into that as seamlessly. So if anything, we're looking at more joint events and working off their resources. Simple as that. When you're an absolute pillar in a niche, You just set something on top of it. You can't really copy it. You just have to trust them as an ally. Other bodies right now are trying to brand, well, where are we? The York Rite is right now is presenting themselves as, we're a continuation of the original Masonic experience, which historically is fully accurate. If you've taken a Blue Lodge degree in the United States, you've taken the York Rite Blue Lodge degrees. To get the rest of the ritual and see both the prequel and the sequel trilogy, you have to join the York Rite. Simple as that. If that's your niche, that's where you go. The Scottish Rite, meanwhile, is a whole diversion clip show off to the side of morality tales and interesting bits of fiction from all over the world, all different faiths. It has Masonic tie, of course, but we're originally French. To this point, everyone knows we're not even really Scottish.
Right.
However, and we have to figure, well, where are we then? I mean, are we academic? Are we a pure theater group? We have to hammer that down. And the thing is, it's not going to be decided by the northernmost jurisdiction and the southern jurisdiction. I have to say that. It's going to be decided by the members and the next generation of leaders. The members are going to choose what they want, and we're going to morph and evolve into some type of organization. And I'm very curious what we end up as. We might end up deeper in the dyslexia centers. We might become deeper in theater again as we were back in the early 1900s. Maybe we do dig into academia. I'm not sure, but I will say the Shrine is already out of their cocoon in their final form.
As we're talking about some of this, you're talking about the days of old. Let's talk about the oldest marketing slogan in Freemasonry, arguably, a peculiar system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols. Good? Bad? Should we go back to this? What did it get us? What do you guys think?
Well, Robert, you just gave me quite a flashback to this. In fact, I flash back to this phrase almost once or twice a week, every week of my life. Let me tell you why. Because the weekend that you and I, Robert, joined the Scottish Rite over in Bloomingdale, was the first year they'd opened the new building in Bloomingdale. Let's see, I rode in with a friend, and we went to the gas station across the street from the valley for cigarettes afterwards. They asked, what are those medals on your chest? And he proceeded to rattle off this slogan in its entirety to the gas station clerk.
I imagine that went over like a blank stare, like, what?
Every time I pass that gas station now, because I'm running rehearsals, board meetings all over the place, even in lockdown, we still have to jump in and out of the place, I still think of that poor man who asked, what are the medals, and being told all these words that he knew from the dictionary, but they didn't quite stream together, and they were said so officially, and my friend was a ritualist, so it all came off very well said. He had the right tone, the right demeanor, the right pronunciation. And just like all Masonic ritual, you have no idea what the heck they just said at first. They want you to dig in and research it. So it's impressive that he said that, but you can't tell, was that religious scripture? are you guys recruiting at the airport? What was that? And if you know enough about each word, you're going to say, okay, that was cool. Thanks for trying to impress me or stun me with big words. Why'd you do that? So no, I picture that poor gas station clerk every time I see this. At the time, yes, it was a decent explanation. There are some dated elements to it. I mean, my personal theory is the fact they call it a peculiar morality, because in the 1700s, what we know now know as basic democracy was quite peculiar. The idea of all members being equal despite their backgrounds, all religions being at the table together, that was peculiar. Now people hear peculiar, they think it's a LARPing convention or model trains or something where you have to warn people at first.
But there's all these factions of Freemasonry. There's like the Masonic LARPing. There's Masonic trains. We are those things.
Robert, we're looking for new clubs at Medina Shriners right now, and don't give me any ideas. I'm starting a board game club right now, which will include Dungeons and Dragons, so don't get on my territory. Don't you dare start a LARP group.
A peculiar system of Dungeons and Dragons, yada, yada, yada. Scott, how about you? What do you think about a peculiar system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols?
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction is that's nice to memorize just so that you never have to have a deeper conversation about it. You know, and I think I go back to the Masonic Roundtable episode on the elevator pitch, and I think that was brilliant because I think you really showed how everybody struggles with coming up with a quick elevator speech on what is Masonry and what is it you guys are doing, you know, and because it's so difficult, like my family really doesn't understand the first thing about my involvement, you know, and I'm, you know, just like you guys, I'm heavily involved. They just don't know where I'm going, what I'm doing, because there's no way to describe it. So I don't love it. It is a brilliant definition. I think probably once you're in the organization, then you can go back and you can learn a lot and you can develop a lot from that. But for someone who doesn't know, I don't know that it's the best description. And honestly, I've reverted back to kind of the things that we used to scoff at, but you start with, oh, do you know who the Shriners are? Yeah, well, they're kind of like us. And I know that that's a bad definition for us, but for the outsider, that works, you know, and this is like the thought of adjusting your message for who you're trying to communicate with, you know?
What do you think about the one that was like around forever until just recently, to be one, ask one? You know, two, Bravo one, ask one.
Yeah, another one that seemed cool as a Mason, but just means nothing to anybody else. Nothing. You know, and if you're marketing message, you know, we saw that on license plate frames and bumper stickers and pins, all with the, you know, with the goal that you're going to get somebody to ask you rather than you asking them. And I think if you go back a little bit further, we have this fantasy at best that, you know, the only way in was if you asked. So you couldn't approach someone, but by you flashing kind of this coded message, someone was supposed to get, oh, they got to ask you about it. And one, that's a fantasy. Like that was never really going on. It might have gone on in little pockets and people ran it like that, but across the board, it's never been like that. That point aside, it just doesn't resonate with anyone. No one's going, oh, I wanted to be a Mason, and now I know all I got to do is ask because I saw this bumper sticker. I don't know that's the best way to get your brand across. And I think about that from the lens of like, if I was going to pitch some short slogan to my team at work, I just don't think that particular one would go over very well. And I think for the reasons I've stated that, like, it's not clear and it doesn't clearly communicate what you're supposed to be doing.
Is there a cool, like, version for your work you could pitch them? To be swole, eat protein, or...
To be swole, ask me.
That's right. It's like when you go to a convention, right? Like whenever I would work a convention or an air show or something back in the day, we all had these shirts that just said, follow me. Like, what does that even mean? No, please don't follow me. I'm working with, you know, hazardous chemicals and fuel. I don't want you to follow me at all. What does this mean? Guide, how about you? 2B1, ask one.
Oh, boy. I've seen this far too often. I joined in 2012. And I've still seen it all over. I've seen the bumper stickers, the pins, everything. It's still at the top of so many pamphlets, materials, etc. I've still heard it as the elevator pitch. When in the 70s, the 80s, I guess, they thought they were drawing back on the myth that, oh, you know, people waited years, but I never got invited to join. I must not be good enough. And like Scott said, it wasn't always true. People usually had more open conversations. Recruiting wasn't public, but at some point you could nudge people in the right direction. So I guess these guys heard the stories and figured, well, no one's joining because they don't know how. So they turned their entire slogan and mission statement into, please, please join us. That's what it comes off as. It doesn't say what we do, what we're about, or who we are. It just says, please join. Like, to be one, ask one, that just says, so I could talk to any of you guys and you're going to get me in? Cool. Great. That's like, hey, are you interested in a special Cabela's credit card? Talk to any staff member. I worked at Cabela's. I still have PTSD from that. But that's what it looked like. Not only have we ignored what we actually do and replaced it with, please join, we just keep saying it over and over again. And then the guys who actually are interested, well, I asked some guy and he kind of gave me the slogan and explained the process. And then that was kind of it. If we give someone something more substantial, some real meat to chew on, you'll Google it when you get home. You'll find a lodge. You'll go from there. You know what we're about. You know the mission statement. Instead, we just have a bumper sticker that says, join us, and the square and compass. That's all it is. That's our mission statement. It was a mistake. Simple as that. It really is an escape we had, and it just cheapens us.
Honestly, the biggest mistake here was whoever created it didn't trademark it and isn't reaping all the rewards of all the pins and all the bumper stickers and everything that could have ever been made from it. That's the real travesty.
Wouldn't it be cool if the guy who made the smiley face and never copyrighted it was also a Mason? You came up with it. Oh, man, you just missed out on millions and millions, the poor man.
All right, so the most recent kind of iteration of something along these lines, right, is really put forth in the Scottish Rites program, right? And when it first came out, you know, I don't know if you ever got flack for it or what, Guy, but I really think that it was an interesting post that you put. In the first word of this article that you wrote says, for those who are alarmed or offended by this title, give me a chance to continue, brother. And this was when Guide published an article for the Midnight Freemasons called Be More Than a Mason. And not as antagonistic against the next slogan, but because there's something to be said that you are more than just a full-time Freemason, right? But what I'm alluding to is the slogan, More Than a Man. The most recent marketing campaign, the most recent hoopla around joining Masonry and what you were alluding to earlier with the Scottish Rite doing the research and the market research and then going out and creating materials and distributing them amongst the different Grand Lodges for their use to build the foundation so that they can have membership is contained within this idea of more than a man. Be more than just a man. Be a Freemason. Guide, you're a presiding officer at the Valley in the Northern Masonic jurisdiction. What say you? More than a man.
Yeah, I knew this was waiting for me sometime down the line. I knew it would come up. I knew when I wrote the article and used that title, it would come up. I knew the pipeline I was in. I have to say, I don't hate the slogan, but I feel it works better as an internal battle cry to give members something to be proud of. We should be proud of Masonry. We should be proud of our heritage, what we do, the work we put into ourselves, by all means. That's an internal battle cry. That is something you put on a plaque inside the lodge. That is something you really assure a brother when he's having a rough time, all right, that we are doing the right thing. However, to use it to replace to be one, ask one, and put it in the public view, I'm not sure if it was on mark. The slogan has a place. It's better than what we had, but I think we needed something a bit more external facing. Because the same problem, to be one, ask one. What do the Masons do? Okay, we're better than people. Is that in a spiritual sense? Are you holier than thou? Are you better morally? Are you better intellectually? Are you really into dieting and cleansing? How are you better? I mean, how are you more than just a normal person? And they just leave you hanging at that. So for people who are looking for Masonry, they see that and see, okay, yeah, I heard they were kind of into self-improvement. Cool, looks like they're on mark. So it's a similar issue to be asked one. They look back at the lore that we build up men into better people, which we do, whether it's incidentally or accidentally, we do, and they built on that. The problem is the average person, if you saw that in a billboard going by, you have no idea what the Masons do, why they're doing it, or who they are. Simple as that. We need a driving action statement. We have an adjective for how we describe ourselves. We don't have a verb.
Yeah, so when I think about that, you said, but do we define what Freemasonry is when somebody asks? And, you know, one of the interesting things that has come out of this marketing campaign is this beafreemason.org website, which is funded by both jurisdictions of the Scottish Rite and some others, including the Shrine. But when you go to beafreemason.org, it's got this, you know, not just a man. And it says a Freemason is committed to bettering himself, his community, and the world. He's on a journey of self-discovery, believing in something greater than himself, a journey in which he will be supported by other good men. Become the best version of you. Answer the call. Begin the journey. And then there are three short paragraphs under what is Freemasonry. The second paragraph likely says the most, I think. Through a series of degrees and ceremonies, the values of Freemasonry are passed from generation to generation, Mason to Mason, in a timeless and tireless effort to make good men better. These degrees provide a framework that affects every aspect of modern life and are based on the values of brotherly love, relief, and truth. And so what I find interesting is, just based on that, is that enough? And for that, I want to pass over to Scott. Is that description enough?
It's tough because I really got hung up with what Guide was saying on the question of how are you better? You know, that's the logical next step in that thought process. And I think that, again, going back to the lack of alignment, you know, our impression or our beliefs of what we are, we can't really define that. And I think that that's kind of where we get hung up.
Well, when we're talking about how we're defining these things, that's, well,
I actually have a question for everybody here. We keep jumping back to, we have so much diversity in Masonry, different motivations, styles, personalities. We're all leadership figures here. We've all been presiding. We've all done regional work. We've all dealt with big, big Masonry. Now, not to say that normal Masonry is small Masonry. Masonry is Masonry. It's always been a smaller experience of up to 30 men sitting around a lodge room. Simple as that. Big Masonry is when you take that and make it statewide, regional, etc., and you have to mass appeal to Masonry. Are we just so terrified of defining what Masonry is? Do we just stay vague and fall back on these platitudes like that? Is it possible that some of these vague campaigns are trying to include everyone at once, but they were afraid if they went too service-based, it would push out the academics. And if they went too esoteric, the service guys would get worried, and so on and so forth. And where do the social guys sit in? Is it just easier to hang back on simple nouns and adjectives and very simple headlines because they just want to keep us all together?
That is soul crushing.
Yeah,
but it is. Like I've often thought about it in the same vein. You know, I look at it as almost the economic model. What happens to 100% socialist countries? It's brain drain. So like, what happens when you go to 100% service model? Right, the academics are going to leave. Now you have potentially less people to help push the mission, or you're taking away an element of coolness, you know, for one whole subgroup of people. Yeah. What do you do? Do we just incorporate everything? Because if we don't, then, you know, it's buckshot. Right, so over to Scott.
I don't think that this is entirely different from the fracturing of the church. And, you know, all of the major world religions have different, you know, different strands. And so I think, you know, we've just allowed that to happen, and it's somewhat organic, but some of it is based on difference in opinion on the way that things are being handled or the way that the scripture is being read. And the same thing is really what we're talking about here. And I think there's probably a valuable exercise to go out and can really kind of sit down and look at, like, what ecumenism means and how that could be of value to Freemasonry, what the analogies are and how the different religions have kind of aligned. And I would say, at least for the area of religion that I'm most familiar with, we allow people to do different things. And so one of the problems is, I think, to Guide's question, the main issue here is that we have to have regularity, that we are so obsessed, and we are obsessed with a couple of problematic things within that, one of them being that we only allow one recognized jurisdiction within a particular boundary. Now, of course, in the United States, because I know someone's going to correct me, I'm aware that in most of the United States, there are actually two jurisdictions within a geography. But that aside, you know, we have multiple brands of Lutherans. We have up a level from that. We have all different types of Protestants, and some of them are getting along, and some of them have agreements, and some of them recognize each other, while others still, you know, they don't. But I think the goal here should be, let's practice the version of Freemasonry that meets your needs, that speaks to you, and let's figure out some way of recognizing people who are going to practice their version of Freemasonry a little bit differently.
Great point. You know, I've talked about marketing and Freemasonry before on some other programs. In fact, I've read a couple pieces by some interesting folks who've had significant marketing careers, Mark St. Cyr being one of them most recently. I want to ask, a lot of the people that we look to for selling Freemasonry or these marketing firms, you know, like I think it's probably plausible that whoever was the face of the company who decided to work for the Northern Masonic jurisdiction to talk about the demographics and all of the studies that they did to pull together their marketing campaigns, it's likely that they said, hey, you know, well, you should just join also so that, you know, our membership doesn't freak out that somebody outside the organization is doing this work. But, you know, we've got a lot of people out there who are doing Masonic marketing for their lodges, social media marketing. We have people who are brothers who have companies that sell Masonic memorabilia and regalia. And what they come to the table with is quite interesting and is a lot different than, say, these quote-unquote big boys who come and help out the huge Northern jurisdiction. And we had this book come out. The book the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction comes out with is Reclaiming the Soul of Freemasonry by past commander John McNaughton. How do you guys feel? Did you guys get a chance to read this, either an ebook or grab a copy? What have you heard about it? I mean, it's kind of old news now, but it's still being cited, and really the groundwork that it laid is still being acted upon.
Yeah, so I wanted to jump in here. I'll admit it's been a long time since I read it. I read it when it first came out. And so I don't remember a whole lot of all the details. And you know, I've experienced a lot of things in marketing since then. And that's probably what I would like to add to this particular approach. And that is that, you know, having worked with a number of agencies in, you know, throughout my career, agencies come with ideas. And then they kind of expect to work with you a little bit on those ideas. You know, they'll do their research and they'll pitch it. But at the end of the day, those agencies, they don't know your brand. They really don't understand your product. And even if you got them to come and join, they're still not really, you know, they're with you for 6 months, 12 months, you know, maybe 24 months. And they're not really going to understand what you're all about. And so there is this necessary, like, pushback. And I, every time I've done this, and I'll tell you, like, I absolutely love the agencies I work with on a day-to-day basis. I hope they're probably not going to hear this, but I don't want them to think I'm being critical of them. We just know that this is what some of that work is like. And they come in and they'll make their recommendations, and then we'll kind of take it and decide what it is we're going to do with it. And that's, I think, a crucial part of knowing how to work with agencies and being able to go back and go, yeah, I'm not really sure if we asked that question right, or I'm going to push back. I'm going to reject this area of their summary. And so I say all that to say, like, those people did their work, and, you know, we've kind of talked about some of the other things that they came up with as a team with the NMJ, and we're talking about the book now. You know, they still did a great job, and this is part of the interaction between, a client and an agency. And so, you know, if there is some differing opinions, like, that's natural. And so it really kind of comes down to us to look at the research ourselves and figure out how to apply that. And I think when I first read the book, that was kind of where our conversations, you and me, Robert, that had gone, was like, well, I like this. I think they're spot on in this area. I don't agree with this way that they've summarized the direction.
Guide, have you had any experience with this particular book? Were you required to do any kind of reading of it, you know, being that you're so involved with the Valley of Chicago?
It's not required by any means, but if you want to get active in the NMJ right now, by all means, you want to look through it and figure out where they're going with it. Now, first things first, I do agree with Scott. It was an outside agency, and at my real job right now, at the Brain Surgeons, we're hiring an outside agency, and we know exactly what's going to happen. They're going to have a standard tool set they're going to apply to us, and they're going to find some data to justify. We're going to find some cool data, but then they'll be offering the whole tool set and the same thing they offer everybody else. So, like Scott said, you have to realize with outside agency, and I say that as a person who might go, you know, form my own agency eventually for causes like this, they can only do so much. They're not going to say, you need this, which I don't fully offer. They might, but then they'll veer you into a direction that they're comfortable with. It's just the nature of the beast. Now, regarding the survey content itself, they did good work, and here's why. That just quote a medical journal I had to work on. What if I told you that officially, according to science, there is no link whatsoever that multiple concussions is bad for you?
Would not surprise me, but you know, that's my world.
Yes. Basically, because science needs a hard example. No one had ever actually sat down and tested multiple concussions in mice to verify, hey, this is bad. Everyone off the street is going to say, yeah, that can't be good for you. They look at football. They look at boxing. They know it's bad, probably linked to Parkinson's, you know, pugilist dementia, all this. But no one had ever connected the dots, and medical science had to say, we're not sure about that. Even though any 15-year-old off the street is going to say, wow, you got hit too many times. It wasn't until someone actually did the study, knowing fully that the results are not going to be surprising at all, until they actually back up and say, okay, maybe we do need to look into this and acknowledge it. Frankly, masonry can be even more stubborn than science. So even though people off the street could say, hey, you know, I think younger members are really into education and more internal charity than external. Social aspect is nice, but I think they like this. You're dealing with hundreds of thousands of members. You're dealing with valleys that have millions of dollars in debt and buildings to maintain, each with thousands of members to deal with on their own, with a rapidly dwindling fraternity to feed from. They're terrified. They can't make strong gambles like that, and they need hard proof. They know that the social events sell. They know their current reunion structure works. They think people like the Dyslexia Center, so we should roll with it. But no one had ever stepped in and did the hard research and proved, hey, young guys like education, and hey, we like this more than that, so on and so forth. Not every move they made might be optimal. I'm aligned with the Normos jurisdiction. I will back it up to the day I die right now. It's tough to be NMJ sometimes, and it's tougher to be proud NMJ. But I will say they managed to prove some things that will improve lives for young Masons. It had to happen. Was it done perfectly? No, nothing is. There's a couple things I looked at. I mean, I'm a sociology major. I looked at some of the data and kind of squinted a bit. But overall, it had to happen at some point. And as a side, I should point out, this is not the first time that the Shrine and the Scottish Rite have gotten together and hired outside consultants. We mostly know of the current research of NMJ, More Than Just a Mason, the education campaign. Back in the 90s, they did the same thing. They had this, because they have more to lose. They have real estate. They have large memberships to feed. They did the exact same thing. They looked into, well, what do young Masons want? In the 90s, their survey indicated golf and fly fishing. I mean, look at us now, all right? We're all basic millennials. Golf courses can't book us because we don't have time and we can't, you know, afford the whole sport. And fly fishing, I don't know what that is. I don't know the difference between fishing. I don't know if there's Olympic fishing, speed fishing. I don't know what that is. But at the time, their survey said that generation liked it. It got to the point, we have green beans. They had, I am so sick of hearing about fly fishing and golf. because their Grand Lodge looked at that survey and started planning everything around those hobbies. So it's not the first time this has happened, but the same thing. They took the research verbatim. And like Scott said, the right way to work with an agency, okay, tell us everything you can about our membership. Cool, thanks. Hey, can you do this for us? Great. Okay, we're going to take this and do this on our own. Thanks for telling us.
Right. But it requires, to that point, it requires marketing professionals really on both sides of that kind of relationship. And I think maybe that's, you know, I don't know what the structure is and who managed that on the NMJ. And I'm with you. Like, I think by and large, we've gone in a positive direction. So I don't want to sound like I'm critical of it. I just, you know, you have to know that that's the way the game is played. That's how this is done. And I would say I would kind of be more clear about what I think we're talking about, and that agency research, when they provide that back to you, that's directional. You know, we use that at work a lot, where it's like, well, this isn't hard data. You know, you're not going to get your PhD, you're not going to be able to defend your PhD on this idea, but it gives us some more information than we had before. And so now we have to decide, you know, hopefully that pushes us in one direction or another. And we can say, you know, at least we have some confidence with going in that given direction. And I really think that's what we're getting at when we're talking about, you know, the way that you interact and react to the info that they give you.
Precisely. Not a lot of professionals are in this fraternity in different fields. Simple as that.
There's a growing disparity of who is, and I say this because I've harped on the idea forever, but it's okay to have expectations, and it's okay to take somebody who real world expertise fits and aligns with Freemasonry. Right, we do the cronyism thing a lot, right? Where somebody gets a position of authority and gets to make these great decisions about Freemasonry, but we don't often ask the question if they're qualified to do so. So, Scott, when you said, you know, there has to be qualified people on both sides of this fence, I can't agree with that more. And, Guy, you just brought home the fact.
It's a sad truth. It is what it is. I mean, we don't have many people who are used to handling, whether it's an appended body with a multi-million-dollar board to handle, whether it's technology usage, whether it's marketing, whether it's business planning, investing, etc. We cling to the experts we find. I mean, if we could find an attorney, oh, beautiful, there's our bylaws expert for the next 30 years. But for the most part, we take someone who has a general gist of it. We don't ask our new members, hey, what do you do for a living? What do you get paid to do? What do you do so well that you can live off of it and we could trust it's up to speed and reliable? A lot of the times, we just say, oh, cool. Yeah, go ask Chuck about that. Chuck's been doing that for years. And Chuck is in a different field altogether. Maybe he's been retired for 20 years. And maybe he said, you know, maybe you could be my assistant. We don't look at our resources and say, hey, brother XYZ is nationally ranked in this. Maybe we should have him take a look at this. Instead, well, so-and-so has been doing this for years. Let's just ride it out. Maybe they could help each other. I mean, I'm working on a campaign right now to change how we handle officership in the Scottish Rite. I'm not recruiting and appointing officers. I am hiring officers. Whatever you need done in Masonry, even if you never collect a dime, even if you're paying for every dinner, driving out, spending your own time on this, you need to hire experts internally for lodge positions. Simple as that. Who has the credentials? Who has the expertise? Who could follow through with it? Are you giving social media to the youngest member just because they're under 50? We have to ask ourselves that.
To those points, you started talking toward the end there about younger members, which brings me to another book that was recently published, I say recently, within the last few years, called 41 Million Men. 41 Million Men is called The Importance of the Millennial Generation to Freemasonry. It is out through McCoy Publishing. And it's like a compilation of essays by different people. And before I ask for either of you if you've read it or any review commentary on it, Terry Tilton, a fellow of the Philalethes Society, he's a past grandmaster of Minnesota, said that his book review was, how do we bring a new generation to Freemasonry? We begin first by understanding who they are what they want, and how Freemasonry can help them make a difference in the world. This is exactly the promise of 4 Million Men, the importance of the millennial generation of Freemasonry. It is a book that should be read by every Grand Master, District Deputy Grand Master, and Worshipful Master. It is an exceptional series of short chapters which answer some of the most vexing problems confronting our craft today. And he says he can't recommend it more highly. Now I know Terry, and I've worked with Terry, and I think, you know, obviously he has, I mean, I love the man. He's got amazing talents and he gets it. Have any of you read, either of you read 41 Million Men or heard of it?
I hate to admit, I have not.
I'm familiar with it. I don't recall if I read it. And I think I'll be honest, I just kind of lost interest at about the time that some of these things were coming out, in that being the path of like, of my Masonic reading. You know, and my Masonic interests and my development, really, I started to recognize, like, I don't have the power to fix some of these problems. And so I no longer see the value in reading that. But I think to Brother Terry's points, it's essential for people who aren't a part of our generation to understand how to work with our generation. Just as important it is for us to read books like The Things They Carried and understand our father's generation who to Vietnam and the greatest generation before that. I think that those things are important, but being a member of the millennial generation, it just kind of lost interest, feeling like no one's listening to us.
Sure. And how do you feel now, though? I mean, let's think about this real quick. I mean, I'm an 81, so according to Pew, I'm a millennial, but according to Google, I'm a zennial. I think about how was Freemasonry marketed to me, and I think that Freemasonry itself had nothing to do with marketing to me. It was more, I had been marketed to through, vague mentions of Freemasonry in comic books and pop culture and other philosophical texts. So that's how I got into, you know, Freemasonry when it was scratching an itch, really. But Freemasonry really wasn't marketed to me. Do you feel, Scott, as a millennial, did Freemasonry market to you and catch you? Or how did you get in? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I found a fascination with a very superficial level of esotericism. And I think that as I think about that, like, that fascination goes back to probably high school. And that's what drew me in. I don't think I recognized that until much more recently, but I don't think it was marketing. I really think that, like, you know, when you look at the boom of Masonic membership, Masonry was punching over its weight, you know, and economic analogy, and I'm no economics expert at all, but you know, when I'm looking at the markets and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to invest in, I look at the price to book ratio, and the book is essentially what your thing is actually worth. And so the higher that ratio is, the more overinflated a stock value is. Well, I think when we look at what happened in the 50s and the 60s, there was this fascination and we got overinflated and we're just returning back to a level. And in reality, like, marketing has never really played a traditional, you know, formal marketing has never really played a role in Masonry.
Let me go over to Guide. I think you are probably Gen Y.
I am 90. I'm Central Millennial.
All right.
Millennial. Gen Y is late 90s or so, but, I'm pretty much, I'm 30 right now, but I'm pretty much Central Millennial.
So was Freemasonry marketed to you?
Never in my life, no. To explain how I got into it, I was a history buff as a kid. I was really into World War II. I was actually reading about the Third Reich camps of Auschwitz and all the different, you know, people who were persecuted there, who lost their lives for horrible causes, etc. And it was a chart of the triangles, and I saw one red triangle, Freemasons. I'm sitting there 15, I'm like, what's that? And of course, I did my Google from there, dug into it. And between that and the general culture, you know, we had Da Vinci Code bopping around, National Treasure, all that. My assumption was, wow, these guys have the coolest list of enemies ever. They must be awesome. I mean, all these dictators, corrupt monarchies, prep religions hated them for some reason. They must be this ultra cool secret society trying to do cool things. I have a deep respect for them. But the thing is, I'm white trash from middle of nowhere. So I thought, okay, you got to be invited. You got to be higher brow. I thought it was invite only, not my thing. All right. It wasn't until I was in college when I used to do stand-up comedy at the House Cafe. It's a trashy little hippie place in DeKalb, Illinois. And my friend's new boyfriend showed up. He had, tattoos all over, a few facial piercings. And I added him on Facebook real quick as we were talking, and I saw he posted something about masonry. I'm like, whoa, wait, you're actually a member? I looked at him, I looked at me, I'm like, wait, we can get in? And I went from there. I was unaware that we were so open to everyone. The whole equality aspects and every walk of life, that never hit me. So even being passionate about the history of the craft and what they'd done, no, they had no idea how to reach me. I think all of us of this generation, we tend to be old souls who wander in knowing a lot about it and wanting to do it personally. We don't wander in, well, my dad always was, and my coworker talked to me about it. Nope. We saw the books, the movies, the video games, and we want that. We sometimes know more about the history than some of the lodge officers when we show up. We do the research and we show up. There's no marketing dust whatsoever.
That's hilarious that you described the way you did. You know, what I'm hearing from both of you is this thing that it's like the romantic legacy. And I say romantic as in the romanticism of the legends. You know, the romantic legacy is really what brought us into the craft. You know, were we thinking, oh, I can't wait to be a part of this. And then when we get here, maybe our passions have sparked us to be more active and to work for the craft because we were like, where's all the romanticism? Where's all this stuff?
I have joined every Masonic body and almost every invitation within my reach. Guys, for everyone who wants to join everything, you don't get a cloak. I've done them all. The waste of life is on the outs.
In terms of marketing, in terms of selling Freemasonry, should we be doing this on a national, global level or a local level? Or not at all? What do you guys think?
Well, that's a tough question to dig into in my position. Because frankly, I've seen the old style lodges. I've heard rumors that people were starting new lodges of small membership, invite only, very quiet, very people focused. They're emulating the traditional experience as much as possible. These aren't the traditional observance lodges. These are their own mold. I'm thinking those lodges are going to outlast the system we have entirely. That's the future of Masonry, I believe. Well, what about my Masonry? What about big Masonry? I have a 2,400-person shrine temple, a 3,000-person valley, and national and state branding to worry about. I'm not sure if it's going to be around at the end of my lifetime. I'm not sure. I think at some point, Masonry will be around. It'll evolve with the times. It'll closer resemble the Cambria Tavern days that we came from. I kind of hope it's going to come full circle, and it's going to become the small group dynamic with more adherence to each other rather than ritual precision or full esoterica. I think it's going to come back to the brotherhood, following tradition of that brotherhood. As for big Masonry, I hate to say it, but let's look at the Detroit Masonic Temple. 1,000 rooms, unused. They're renting out large sections of it. They nearly lose it every few years. It was built during a boom in Masonry and never fully utilized. I'm worried that someday that's going to be my valley. That's going to be my shrine temple. It's a possibility. I'm worried that someday we might keep around the Scottish York and shrine degrees as side orders like we do the Allied Masonic degrees right now. But I might be running an organization right now that won't be around someday. I hate to admit that.
Scott, how can we effectively market something that's got no official vision? We talked about on-brand messaging and how do we fire on all cylinders and this kind of buckshot approach? But is there a way to effectively market something that has no acute statement of value?
On a large scale, I don't think so. But I think that there is a smaller scale that then is also probably scalable. I don't know that across the NMJ or the Southern jurisdiction that you can come up with one thing that everyone's going to go go for, but maybe not. You know what? It's possible. You know, we've been to the southern jurisdiction, and we know that they're at least a handful of the valleys, mine included, is focused on education, and that's what everything is about. And you're there for the full experience, but it kind of circles around education and quality degree work. And to our valley up here in Chicago, the same focus is there as well. It's just there's other things that also interest. So it's the sort of thing where over time, we might just see some of those interests fall away. And really the one thing I wanted to bring up in this talk is the concept of DNA, and knowing what your organization is about. And so I think it starts by, if you're with an existing organization, something that's been around for an extended period of time, like the Valley of Chicago, many of our lodges, then you need to sit back. And I know Guy's doing wonderful work on this and he's pushing this. It's not an easy task, but you have to sit back and figure out who are we, and know that like when you look at the shrine, there are things that I could toss out and you could say, nope, that's the shrine's thing. We can't do that. And with all of the other bodies in masonry, that's not really the case. You know, there are very few things where you go, oh, you want to do a haunted house up here? That's Barrington's thing. You know, better make sure that's cool with them first. You know, that kind of thing. So like groups like that, they know what they're about. They know the things that they do on a regular basis. And of course, they're one of the largest lodges up here in northern part of Illinois. But I think, you know, I'm meandering a bit on some of these ideas, but I do think knowing your own organization and being able to clearly state what your DNA is critical. And how you get there probably are a lot of different paths. When we look at valleys, you're probably going to start to see you're going to gravitate towards one direction or another, and then you're there and just live there. There's no reason to try to force it to something else and lose the membership you have. You know, if your valley is about social engagement and doing activities and sometimes doing philanthropic stuff, then do that. Still have the ritual, and that's what I think is the one common thread, but do those things. You know, we started our lodge with a very focused approach and said, this is what our lodge is going to be about. So like, unlike almost every other organization in masonry, we started from ground zero and said, this is what we're going to be about. And you're either into this or you're not. And that's cool. We still love you as a brother, but the guys who are into this, they're going to become a part of this lodge. And so, you know, now, you know, people in the area know we're the lodge for X, Y, or Z. And that's like, that is our brand and that's our DNA. And so, you know, all of those things kind of come together and are going to be necessary for that marketing on any larger scale. I definitely think that's scalable. But it may take some time.
Scott, I have to build on that. I think there is a way we could really narrow things down long term. We keep mentioning the shrine so positive because they have their brand on point. There was a while back, someone approached me and said, hey, could you talk to the shrine about doing history or maybe the symbolism, maybe some esoteric of the shrine? I looked at them and said, they're everything they need to be. Simple as that. I mean, if they try to branch out like others do, it just doesn't quite work out. So we might have organizations that are academic or historical, but they're still trying the charity aspects. They're still kind of tacking on a cause, or they're trying to throw parties like the shrine does because, well, the shrine pulls it off and they seem to be doing okay. I actually got this from, in booking all my speakers for the Valley of Chicago. Now, for people who don't know this, I try and book a national speaker for the Valley of Chicago once a month through lockdown. We're going to continue that afterwards, and hopefully that keeps on after I'm out of office. But one of my first speakers was the one and only Brett Morris. So in talking with him just brother to brother about the speak about it, I kind of mentioned, I was terrified, of course, because it's Brett Morris. I'm like, I'm trying to find, you know, what topics our brothers are going to like the most, you know, what we have to offer. And he shut me down with the most beautiful way. He's like, what do you have that no one else has? And before I could respond, he said, whatever it is, that's your niche. That means so much to me. I mean, it almost can stretch out to life, your career. Whatever your lodge, your form of masonry, or whatever your appendant body has that the others can't copy, that only you have, I think that's the DNA that Scott is describing, and that's what's going to hang in there. Something is going to shine through, and it's going to come down to that element. What does your body, what does your lodge bring that others don't? In the end, that's what people are going to come for, and if they could discover that, I think they might be able to make it.
Yeah, I would that. Say there's another step on there, just based on my past life and different things I've done in masonry, is like, once you figure that out, then you hold that and a more objective view of what masonry is. You hold those two things together and you go, are these two things similar? Is there an overlap? Is there any overlap in these two circles? Or are they totally different? And I think it's really problematic. And we have too many organizations where, by everyone's objective definition, not just Scott's subjective definition of masonry, but the larger objectivity of it, if there's no overlap, man, we got a problem. And your organization just doesn't need to exist. And we need to let those groups kind of go away. Or try to figure out how to bring those two things together. But I have seen examples, plenty of examples, where the thing that your lodge has is not a Masonic thing. It's just a thing. You know, if the thing that your lodge has is you're just a bunch of guys who know each other, well, that's not inherently Masonic, and that's problematic. You know, now really you're just a bunch of guys who hang out at a Masonic temple and pay rent there.
I have a good friend of mine who has been listening to the show for a long while, both this show and Masonic Roundtable. He will get the joke when I say, if all you got is crushing cans, it's not much of a lodge. There are lodges that exist to pay for scholarships, and that's the entire scope of the lodge and what it revolves around. And while that's great, it's kind of community building. You know, we have to look at who those scholarships are going to. Is it just members of the lodge, or are you giving them to the greatest academics coming out of the institutions of the area? I think about things like that, and if that is going to be your deal, then gosh darn it. I mean, I guess you got to own it and maybe, hopefully, you know, Guide, you said hopefully they can find you based on whatever that niche is. And if they can find you, maybe you're doing an okay job in marketing. Maybe you're not. I don't know. Let's go to Guide. A comprehensive plan, sure, that's needed, but whatever. What's a first step or a change when we consider marketing Freemasonry, selling Freemasonry to an audience that's available today?
Well, the first initial change, we need to get over ourselves. That sounds terrible. That sounds a bit blunt at first, but we need to get over the exclusivity of some of our titles, some of our positions, our hierarchy, how much we love certain groups. We need to get over our history. The issue with to be one, ask one, and more than a man, a Mason, is because we fall back on, well, everyone's always respected the Masons. You know, we founded the country and all this, and all these revolutions, and all the streets are, you know, shaped in our symbol and all that. We have this assumption that, well, we're Masons. I mean, we're hundreds of years old or thousands of years old if you ask the wrong people. That doesn't have value. People who are looking into our fraternity want to know right now, what can you do for me? What can I gain from you? What kind of journey are you going to take me on? We're so stuck in our loop branding of, oh, yeah, we're so awesome. Hey, you want in on this? We need to get more sincere. We need to be more humble about what we do. We need to be more mission-focused. We can't just keep throwing up Square and Compass, George Washington, a bunch of celebrities who joined and never showed up. Voltaire went to one meeting, guys. We need to stop dropping him. We need to get down to what we do, what we want people to do when they join, and how we're going to survive this. Simple as that. We need to be mission-focused, not masonry focused. People ask me, like, so all you guys do is study and talk about yourselves. I mean, think about it. It's kind of true. We go on about our history. We go on about famous Masons we've known or the history of this lodge or that, different protocols and the ritual over and over again. Marketing-wise, we need to break that down into, okay, what are you going to get from this? We can't just say, oh, it's great, you'll see. No, 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 no. We need to get up front. What is the value of masonry, and how do we put that up front? We're putting our trophy case up front when it's covered in dust and most of the guys who won it are dead. We need to be the coach recruiting for a player right now. We need to stop leaning on the trophies in the history.
Scott, same question. Without a comprehensive plan, obviously that's got to exist at some point, but if you have to throw something together right now, at first, what's a first step or a change you got to make?
Yeah, before I jump into that, I think there's some brilliant things that Guy touched on there that I would just add, that I think that idea of kind of leaning on history or leaning on other people as a proxy for your quality, that's not just a historical, we're not just leaning back, we're leaning, you know, sideways, we're leaning on a handful of examples, you know, and that's true even about the philanthropic stuff we do. We lean on, say, the Shrine, you know, and I use that as an example. I myself am not a Shriner. That's not a secret. It's not something that really is why I'm in Masonry. And so that's, you know, I love a great number of my closest friends are Shriners, but we lean on the endowment and the philanthropy there. And a great many of the people that are talking about that are donating $25, $35 a year. You know, so there's a problem with just this whole idea of using all these proxies rather than being yourself a great man. And this is something I think about a lot. It's like the reason why people respected Masonry historically is because we had among our members really great men, but they were great men in spite of Masonry. They would have been great men, like George Washington would have been a great man regardless of whether he ever put on an apron or not. It has nothing to do with Masonry. And yet we lean on that and we use that as a proxy. And this is a historical thing. I do give, RJ's heard me talk about this in some of my talks where we really like to glom onto that rather than, and this will dovetail perfectly into my answer with to the question, which is know yourself. Start there. And as you begin to understand who you are yourself, you're going to understand the role that Masonry plays in your life, and you're going to be able to communicate that or at least walk a potential brother through the process of understanding what Masonry does. And I think far too many people don't do that. They would just rather, like Guy said, rather lean on the trophies, lean on how great we have been in the past or how great some of us are today, and not kind of do that own our own work of improving ourselves and using that kind of experience to start the conversation. And so I think about when I have a guy who says, hey, I'm interested in Masonry and, you know, what can you tell me about it? And then usually my first statement is I'll tell you whatever you want to know. Because of course my perspective is that the real important things, the real lessons, I can't really verbalize, you know, so I could tell you everything and it's never going to matter. It's never going to make you a better person. I think just that fundamental thing, that small shift in our understanding of Masonry could be critical. And I think that these small changes happen on a small scale. And it's why my belief is put as much effort as you can in a local. And that local, I would say, can mean the lodge. It can also mean the valley. I'd love for it to mean the York Rite. I'm not sure if that's going to ever be the case, but I think that you can start to shift people's consciousness and awareness of this fundamental idea of what Masonry really is.
Love it. I love where we've gone in this particular episode talking about what started as selling Freemasonry. You know, as we pull the covers back and we turn into Sherlock Holmes, you know, poring over the bed with a looking glass, we're finding much bigger clues and issues, and we're pulling the thread on these things. And I think the listeners to this particular episode are probably going to come away with some interesting ideas about what they can do. And as they walk away from this episode, I want to go back to Guide for a final word. Anything else that, you know, you want to add in that you think would be valuable to somebody who's coming away with this with aha moments, you know, the eurekas?
To refine what I've been saying about leaving behind history, leaving behind extraneous marketing, doing things right, you have to take one step. You need to think of what drove you to knock on that door three times. What was it like waiting outside as your first degree was about to start, before you were initiated, your last few moments before you saw what all this was? What took you there? Many of us forget that time and time again. the meetings stack up, the ritual becomes just something we mumble as we drive, the stress can wear us down, the glimmer, you know, fades. You know, we go from I get to dress up to lodge to that I already wear this tie, what's it going to look like? We need to get back to that initial moment. We need to bottle that excitement. And it's not just going to save your lodge by selling the value. It's going to save your adherence to masonry. It's going to bring you back to why we do this. We need to refine why we're here to begin with. We might not continue doing everything. Not every group may survive, but masonry needs to in its purest form. As we need to sell that, keep that in mind. Ground yourself in masonry. Remember where masonry is in your life, what it provides, what it is, and what it isn't. And frankly, as you live it, it might just sell itself.
Scott, over to you. Final thoughts.
Masonry has been immensely important in my life. I would not be the person I am. I would not know the people I know. I would not be the husband I am or the parishioner I am if it weren't for masonry. And so, you know, when I think about selling Freemasonry, yeah, you have to take a leap of faith. When someone comes and asks me about Freemasonry, I tell them, hey, I can give you some guidance, but at some point you're going to have to trust me. And I remember vividly taking that leap of faith myself. And so I know, and I know what that felt like. And I try to put myself back in that mentality a lot like Guide mentioned, thinking about right before you became, you were, you know, the veil was lifted and you saw what this was all about. I remember thinking, maybe this is kind of weird. Maybe it is something I'm not going to want to be involved in and that I'm going to wish I hadn't done. But the people who are guiding me to this point, whatever that force has been and whoever those people have been, I trust those people to take the next step. And I think that when you can speak with clarity and from the heart on this idea that masonry, you have to just trust me that masonry has made a significant impact in my life. And when I tell you that I think it can make an important impact in your life, that I'm not just making that up. I wouldn't tell you that, you know, we're close enough, or hopefully I'm conveying a genuine message enough to say, you can trust me on this. And I think that that's critical.
Something I think you guys both eloquently put is the idea of self-reflection and thinking about where you were and why you joined, which just may be enough of a sell for anybody asking. One of the questions I had thought about asking early on as I was putting together my notes for this particular episode was perhaps, you know, marketing Freemasonry is irrelevant, and maybe it's just, as Guide said, as a living example of a person who exhibits these greater qualities. Oh, and back to Scott's point, they just happen to also be a Freemason. Something about the fraternity seems to attract interesting individuals. Not always great individuals, we know that. You guys, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on this episode, lending your time and your talent in the real world and applying that to the question of selling Freemasonry. So, Brother Scott, Brother Guide, thank you guys so much for coming on the program.
Absolutely. I'm glad you invited us to participate. I'm humbled to really get to participate in this kind of conversation with Guide. Obviously, I think the world of the work he does both in and outside of masonry. And don't sell yourself short, Robert. I mean, you've done some incredible things, marketing wise for the fraternity and for the things that you've put out there. So, really just, thankful to be a part of this conversation.
I am just proud to have ended up at this table. All right. There's a lot of self-doubt in what I do. I mean, waking up the position I am is quite interesting in general. But to know that I'm being heard and that these methods are worth repeating and it's not just me throwing these shots out in the dark, it's a good affirmation that this works. Just hard work, scientific thought, caring about the numbers, it means a lot. So thank you for giving me that chance to affirm that.
Absolutely. And everybody out there, you know, we'll post links to a lot of the different things that we talked about on the episode, Guide's article, some of the TMR episodes that dealt with some of the things we talked about, as well as anything else that Brother Scott and Brother Guide. If you guys decide on sending me anything else, I'll make sure I put those in the show notes as a recommended reading for our listeners. Once again, I want to thank you, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you guys soon. Well, there you have the conversation we had earlier this week. I want to once again thank Scott and for sharing their expertise with us. I can honestly say I'm smarter now that I've listened to them. So I hope you feel the same. If you have questions about anything, please go ahead and shoot me an email. I will forward those questions on to Guide and to Brother Scott as I get them if you have questions. You can find most of the things that we talked about in the conversation as links in the show notes. For our craftsmen out there who like to think and work, a new segment in this show that I'm going to try and do every episode is ask a couple of questions for introspection. Given what we heard today and what you know of Freemasonry in your jurisdiction, in your area, your local Masonic lodges, I'll ask you. Of course, all of these things need a comprehensive plan, but for you, what do you think, based on what you have observed, what's the first step or the first change you would make in order to sell Freemasonry better? And a follow-up question, should Freemasonry come up with a single vision plan or a single mission statement to encompass all of, quote-unquote, regular Freemasonry? Just some interesting things to think about. I look forward to reading your responses, and I'll be talking with you all next week. One more time, I want to thank our contributors, our fellows, our producers for their continued efforts to support the WCY podcast. You guys are simply amazing. If you are curious on how to support the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and check out the Support the Show section of the website. You'll see our three main tiers for Patreon and PayPal, as well as two enhanced tiers that might interest you, including a tier that allows you to essentially direct an episode. So that's it for this week. We'll talk to you all next week. And until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.